Thank you very much for coming. My name is Joel Barkin, a senior associate here at CSIS. And it's a particular pleasure to welcome Andrew Mwenda here this afternoon, partly because I've been chasing Andrew on behalf of CSIS for about 2 years now. And I haven't seen him face-to-face in that time. And since then, he has evolved from the precocious child prodigy of Yoweri Museveni, meaning a thorn in the president's hide, and a bulwark of the independent press in Uganda, to a member of the international press establishment, if I might perhaps even say that. He is here in Washington for the Committee to Protect Journalists. His paper, The Independent, for which he's the managing editor, was raided last night. There's a story in today's Washington Post that is in front of you. This gives you some idea of what it takes to be an independent journalist and pursue serious investigative journalism in the context of Uganda today. Mr. Mwenda was previously with The Monitor, another paper in Uganda, with the second largest circulation, am I right in that? And he was with The Monitor until 2005 when he took a year off to go to Stanford as a night fellow in 2005-2006. In the course of his being away, The Monitor let it be known that he wasn't entirely welcome on his return. Is that a fair way of putting it? But instead of relocating elsewhere, and to really give you an indication of Andrew's courage, he was able to start The Independent, which is quite a feat, starting a paper from scratch. And as I indicated, he's the managing editor of the paper. Along the way, he was also the moderator of an extremely successful FM talk show in Kampala, which interviewed everybody from President Museveni to Jeffrey Sachs. And I mentioned that one because I remember listening on a download to Andrew's interrogation of Jeffrey Sachs, and when Professor Sachs was launching into his usual mantra of more aid will solve the problems of the poor, Andrew lectured him instead on moral hazard. And I'm sure he never expected this kind of an argument coming from a young journalist out in that part of the world. So without further ado, it's a great pleasure to welcome you here. Unfortunately, the number of programs that we've been able to mount on Uganda have not been quite as frequent as we've liked. We've had a few, but this is the first one in over a year, and a lot has happened in Uganda since that time. The status of President Museveni himself and whether he's ramping up for a fourth term, the current status of the ceasefire with the LRA, a variety of topics which we look forward to hearing you cover in the next 30 minutes or so, and then we'll throw it open to the floor. So welcome again to CSIS in Washington.
Thank you very much. Switch. There we go. Thank you very much, Joel, for that generous introduction. Joel said you can see what it takes to be a journalist or an independent journalist in Uganda. What it takes is that sometimes you can be taken to government residence, given free food and airtight security. I have always lived my life by paying rent and buying my own food and hiring my own private security. So each time I'm taken to jail, at least I have all those three for free. That's the only time I get to enjoy my taxes in Uganda. Well, I'm supposed to speak about conflict and governance in Uganda and what the U.S. can do to promote the cause of democratization in Uganda. These days, my view about what the outside world should do is always what the outside world shouldn't do. So I will not discuss what the U.S. should do, but rather what it shouldn't do to promote democracy in Uganda. The conflict in northern Uganda has been on for 22 years, and you may be concerned, why doesn't it end? We are informed by the government of Uganda that Joseph Kony has about 900 soldiers. At some times he has 110, most of them abducted children who are therefore involuntary combatants, poorly armed, poorly trained, underfed. How can it be possible that they can put up a sustained resistance against the mighty Uganda People's Defense Forces, which is 50,000 troops strong, with tanks, helicopter gunships, MiG fighters, a constant supply of food and money provided by the international donor community? I personally think that the war has been persistent for so many years because it has been functional for Uganda from President Yoweri Museveni's politics. And it is that has eluded most commentary on Uganda. See, the war in northern Uganda actually taps into our own ethnic differences in Uganda. When President Yoweri Museveni entered, or the National Resistance Army entered northern Uganda, I think from a very personal view, and that is personal to Museveni, he looked at the population in Acholi, where this war takes place, as the enemy, and looked at the rebels as the armed wing of the enemy. So the enemy was the ethnic group. The rebel group was only an armed wing of this wider resistance. And for him to prosecute that war, he needed to separate the Acholi population from the Acholi combatants, whom he did not distinguish as different. And that laid the foundation for the emergence of what are called internally displaced people's camps. Human beings were taken into these artificial prisons and kept there so that they cannot have access to the rebellion or to the rebels by supplying them food, weapons, intelligence, and recruits. Please remember that Mr. Yoweri Museveni came to power after a 5-year guerrilla war in central Uganda, and during that war, all attempts at counter-insurgence operations by the then government of Uganda were characterized by a lot of violence against the civilian population. The response of the civilian population was supply food, supply intelligence information, supply recruits to the rebels. So Museveni clearly understood that the rebellion cannot succeed without the active support of the citizens. So when he confronted a similar rebellion in northern Uganda, he understood the population to be part and parcel of that rebellion, just as he had the population in central Uganda had been part and parcel of the rebellion. And he separated the two using IDPs, internally displaced people's camps. For as long as so many people were interned in these camps, they could not provide food, they could not provide intelligence information, neither could they provide recruits to the rebellion. This policy, I think, would never have succeeded had it not been for the international humanitarian community, because immediately people were put in the camps. The international humanitarian community arrived with food, insufficient medicines, to subsidize government policy. First of all, remember that the government of Uganda put people in these camps and did not supply them food, did not supply them medicine or housing. By the international humanitarian community providing these benefits to the people there, it altered the political terrain in northern Uganda, because if people had been left in the camps uncared for, most likely they would either have joined the rebellion and therefore altered the balance of power in the conflict, or they would have joined the government, but whichever side they would have joined would have fundamentally altered the nature of the conflict. The second thing about that war is when Museveni captured power, his ability to consolidate his position was dependent on him accessing international financial assistance. At the time he took power in 1986, Uganda's economy and state had both collapsed. State collapse was evidenced in the proliferation of different armed groups that controlled the city of Kampala. The absence of basic institutions of state, the police, the army, and the prisons to ensure basic law and order, and the absence of institutions of state like the ministries of education and health to deliver basic services like health and education and infrastructure. For Museveni to legitimize his position in power, he needed two things. One, he needed to reestablish security. Two, he needed to reestablish order. Three, he needed to ensure that there are best goods and services in shops. Rather, there are goods in shops and services in hospitals and schools. And finally, all those would secure him the necessary legitimacy, especially in southern Uganda, for him to be able to prosecute the war in northern Uganda. But the economy had collapsed, so how would he raise money? He went to the international community begging. The international community started giving him money. Therefore, from the beginning, foreign aid has been an important political resource in Museveni's project of political consolidation. When that money arrived in you to support his existence, it came with conditions attached. One of the conditions the donors always imposed on him was that he must surrender economic decision-making and orientation to the international donor community. And two, he must also allow the international donor community to have control and supervision of how the budget of Uganda is made. And this is one of the bargains that sustained the war in northern Uganda, because the impact was that Museveni had to accept international donor policy recommendations, privatization, deregulation, removal of state monopolies, liberalization of foreign exchange. All these economic reform policy recommendations were not simply economic policy reform recommendations. They had serious political implications. If you privatize public enterprises, how does the system reproduce itself? How does it create patronage for its followers? If you remove state monopolies, then you are removing rents that were necessary to bribe elite constituencies in order for them to support the existing government. If you have donors controlling the budget, how can then the government divert resources from the budget to finance its patronage? Now, Mr. Yoweri Museveni is one of the smartest politicians of the last century in Africa. One of the things he understood early, I think, this is my strong suspicion, was that it is better to hold a small slice of a growing pie than a large slice of a shrinking one. And in that bargain, he understood that it is better for him to secure foreign aid in exchange for surrendering economic control to the donors. But for him to generate revenue, he needed an excuse. The existence of a conflict in northern Uganda was an important excuse for Museveni to forever increase defense spending. And defense spending was not increased to finance military operations. It was increased as a slush fund to finance political patronage. So the conflict became increasingly functional from Museveni's politics, because where donors were controlling the budget, where donors had taken a lot of resources from the control of the state into the private sector through privatization and liberalization, the war became a means through which he could increase the defense budget and then cream off the defense budget to finance his patronage. One of the examples is that by 1992, the conflict in northern Uganda had almost been defeated or had been ended through the defeat of the LRA. At that time, military spending in Uganda was $44 million. By 2004, the rebellion was spreading across the whole country and military spending was $250 million. So, in spite of a 500% increase in the defense budget, there was no improvement in the capacity of the military to prosecute the war. Instead, what we saw is the army became a springboard for private profiteers. They placed ghost soldiers on the army register. In 2003, a commission of inquiry into the study of ghost soldiers in Uganda found out that $40 million per year goes to finance ghost soldiers. These are soldiers that exist on the army register, but do not exist in fact. It also created opportunities for the procurement of heavy military equipment. And I have an article in the Review of African Political Economy on military corruption in Uganda. I co-authored with a friend of mine called Roger Tangri. You may read it. It is a documentation of the different cases of corruption where the procurement of army food, army uniforms, and military equipment was characterized by high levels of corruption. They would buy undersized uniforms. expired food rations, junk helicopters, junk MiG fighters, junk 100 millimeter anti-aircraft guns. But this corruption created opportunities for soldiers in conflict areas to profit from corruption. You may begin to ask yourselves, if army officers are profiteering from a conflict, would they have a strong incentive to end that conflict? The other thing about the war in northern Uganda is that the brutality of the rebels, the LRA, cast the government of Uganda in the image of a victim of fanatic aggression by a demented cult. And with that image, it brought a lot of international sympathy to the government of Uganda, and with international sympathy also came international humanitarian aid and international financial aid to the government. Finally, the war was also functional for Museveni's politics because it provided for him the perfect excuse to clamp down on his opponents and on the independent media by claiming that we were threatening national security. I have 21 criminal charges against me in the criminal courts of Uganda, and of those, 17 relate to me threatening national security. If you look at the arrest warrant that was issued yesterday against me, it says that I published information that is prejudicial to the security of the state. I actually think it's an honor for me to be of such a great influence to threaten the security of the entire state of Uganda. But the point is that the existence of rebellion in northern Uganda has been a political boon for the government because it can arrest journalists who write critical articles on the government by claiming that they are endangering national security. In the last elections, the last presidential elections, one of the opposition presidential candidates, Mr. Kizza Besigye, stayed in jail for 2 months during the campaigns. Why? He was arrested for treason, that he was colluding with Joseph Kony to overthrow the government. So the rebellion seems to me to have provided President Yoweri Museveni with a perfect excuse to clamp down on the opposition, claiming that they are siding with the rebellion. Now, when I say that the rebellion has been functional for his politics and therefore has created a lot of incentives for him to prosecute, not to end the war, but to sustain it, I am not suggesting that there were no other incentives that on the part of Museveni to end this conflict. Oh, by the way, I should mention also, I had forgotten, that the conflict was also functional because Museveni was using that conflict to finance the SPLA, the Sudan People's Liberation Army. By financing the SPLA, that brought him at the heart of the United States' geostrategic interests in our region. He understood very early on that America's opposition to Khartoum meant that the United States would support the SPLA. If he supported the SPLA, then he would be the leader of the frontline states against the spread of terrorism or Islamic fundamentalism. If he was in that position, then the Americans would give him cover. At the United Nations, he would avoid censure because the American government would give him diplomatic support, but also he would benefit from American military assistance. And I have had a discussion personally with Museveni one time. I remember he told me that if you want to consolidate your position in power in Uganda or in an African country, one, the first and most important, you must ensure that the British and the Americans are always on your side. And how do you keep them on your side? You must pursue the agenda in the region for them to be able to support you. Two, he told me that you'd need the support of South Africa and Tanzania. I never came to understand why he thought that Tanzania and South Africa were vital props for regime survival in Uganda. So you can clearly see that if the war ended, and it would only have ended possibly by him seeking diplomatic rapprochement with Khartoum, two, it would have ended by him pursuing a successful military strategy to defeat Kony, or three, it would have ended by him seeking a political settlement with not only Kony but the population of northern Uganda. Neither of those was attractive, given that the war was placing him at the heart of U.S. and British geostrategic interests in the Great Lakes region. But there were some incentives from Museveni to end that conflict. For example, if you know him personally, his big ego, I am sure, would have made him feel like he should be the champion of warfare in Uganda. And therefore, the failure to defeat Kony is a big dent on his personal ego, to be the guy who defeated, the general who defeated all those who fought against him. Secondly, the war has undermined the rate of economic growth and poverty reduction in Uganda. I am sure the number of people living below the poverty line in Uganda is 31%. In northern Uganda, it is 69%. So if you remove northern Uganda, you'd find that actual poverty in Uganda is, the people living below the poverty line outside of northern Uganda are about 18% of Uganda's population. So northern Uganda has been a dent. Museveni is a development fundamentalist. He wants to be a Lee Kuan Yew or a Park Chung-hee who has transformed Uganda. And northern Uganda has always undermined his desire to rapidly and economically transform Uganda. Finally, the persistence of the conflict has robbed him of the image of a statesman, either as a peacemaker or a great military victor like Genghis Khan. And I think that all those were... Museveni had some incentives to end the war. My argument is that the incentives not to end it at every twist and turn appeared stronger. And please do not misunderstand my presentation to mean that I'm arguing that Museveni deliberately colluded with his generals to say, let us sustain the war in order because it is beneficial to us. No. My argument is that the incentives I put in place, the functions that this conflict, the benefits this conflict brought to his project of consolidating power in Uganda, always interacted with his desire to end the conflict and undermine that desire. For example, whenever he was negotiating with donors of the Paris Club to increase defense spending, he clearly understood that he needed a conflict in the north. That is why every time the meeting of the Paris Club was going to take place, the conflict would escalate and the negotiations would take place under conditions where there are so many people dying. And it became clear to me by around 2002, 2003, 2001, that each time the Paris Club meeting was going to take place, whether in Kampala or in Paris, there would be huge humanitarian catastrophe. And I felt that somehow the army withdrew deliberately to allow Konyi to kill. And then you'd have these people from the West, largely white, with a lot of liberal sensibilities, seated with this African president and then and his team. And he says, listen, you are saying I cut defense spending. Look, there is a catastrophe in northern Uganda, and they would find it very difficult morally to say, okay, we are going to say, no, we will not allow you to increase the defense budget. Always he was able to successfully blackmail them, because African presidents understand the mentality, attitudes, and approaches of people in the West to issues like this. Once you have a conflict and people dying, that's enough bribe to convince people from the West to give you more money for defense, even though you're going to steal all of it and finance your political patronage. So, I seem to have more time than words that I can say. In the last 3 years, since 2005, a peace process has started in northern Uganda. Now the question is, will this peace process lead to peace? I personally think yes, but for different reasons. One, the comprehensive peace agreement in southern Sudan removed one of the key instruments that Museveni was using to sustain that conflict. Now that there is a government in southern Sudan, Konyi is no longer receiving as much support from the government in Khartoum as before. As a consequence of that, he also lost his rare base. Each time he was beaten in Uganda, he ran into southern Sudan. So unable to get sufficient arms and ammunition, unable to get money to feed his ragtag troops and buy supplies for them, but also unable to have a secure rare base where he can run and hide whenever they're going to get stuff in Uganda, Konyi is largely a defeated force. And therefore, Museveni will find it easier to negotiate a peace with Konyi, because Museveni's strategy has always been, one, defeat the enemy militarily, and then two, negotiate the terms of their surrender. In what he calls peace talks, but which literally are surrender talks, then integrate the enemy's troops in your army, give the political leaders of the rebel group positions in the military and in the political sphere, and then that way you neutralize them. So right now he has that opportunity to do it with Konyi. The second is the politics inside the government of Southern Sudan. Remember that many people in the government of Southern Sudan share a common ethnic background with Mr. Konyi, and they would not want to see Konyi defeated militarily. And that is why they pushed the government of Southern Sudan towards a negotiated peace settlement. And Museveni understands that if he does not resolve the problem of Kony and LRA, they may actually lead to a conflict between the government of Uganda and the government of Southern Sudan, if he's not careful. And I'm sure he's aware of that. And finally, the international donor community has been taken for a long ride, and I am sure many of them have realized that he is playing games with them. And there has been much more concerted effort on the part of the international community to force Museveni to reach a peace agreement with Kony. And all these factors have pushed him towards a peace agreement, which is not really a peace agreement, but a surrender agreement with Kony. Kony has not yet signed, but I do not see many options on his part. The only option he has is that if Southern Sudan votes to become independent, then Mr. Joseph Kony can reemerge as a factor in the region, one, either by siding with Khartoum in order to destabilize the government of Southern Sudan, or in the event of a conflict between Salva Kiir, the president, and his vice president, Riek Machar, Kony can emerge as one of the factors, forces behind Riek Machar. So in that regard, we can still keep our fingers crossed because the conflict may not have come to an end. We may see it transform into a regional conflict. So what should the U.S. do to promote the cause of democracy in Uganda? First of all, I think that they should discuss what the U.S. government should not do. It has been doing too many things. I am among the very few Africans who are afraid that the election of Barack Obama may increase U.S. involvement in Africa through giving African governments more money. So what the U.S. government should do is, first of all, to shift from giving too much money to the government of Uganda. Whether it is for purposes of health, infrastructure, whatever it is, U.S. aid to Uganda needs to be significantly reduced. And please remember, I'm not saying that it should be reduced because I think it's a punishment to government of Uganda for misbehavior. I think it should be reduced or eliminated because aid is a bad instrument of development policy. It distorts incentives of government. Rather than a government focusing on its own citizens on how it can make them prosperous, it focuses more on how to manipulate and beg international donors for money. So I think that the idea that aid is the solution to our problems is a wrong idea. So the first thing to do is, please, let the U.S. use its influence, both with the World Bank, the IMF, and its own USAID department, its Agency for International Development or something like that, to campaign that we need to reduce the amount of free money that is being given to the government of Uganda. If you cut down that aid significantly, Mr. Yoweri Museveni and his cohorts will find it in their own self-interest to listen to the private sector in Uganda, including the independent, about policies and institutions that are necessary to increase the productivity of the citizens of Uganda. If Museveni depends on Ugandans for revenues, tax revenues to finance his existence in power, his large new patrimonial system, I can assure you that the incentive on his part to engage the people of Uganda, to grant political liberty in exchange for resources to finance his budget, will be very high. Thank you very much.
Andrew has pursued a number of themes that he's written about in the past and elaborated on them. I'd like to take the liberty of the first question and ask you to comment more specifically on essentially Kony's posture now. He is essentially reduced to a small area up in the Congo. It's been reported that the government of Uganda may, in fact, be providing support for him to stay in that area. One sticking point is the charge with the International Criminal Court that Uganda referred to the court and now cannot withdraw. And you didn't mention that sticking point, and I wonder whether you might address that. And I also would like you to bring us up to date in respect to your final comment, in which you're basically made an allusion to budget support, which the United States, by the way, does not provide to Uganda, but which the World Bank and others do. What is actually the status of budget support to the government of Uganda at the present time? Because the British moved slightly away from it a couple of years ago. what is the current flow of budget support? Because without it, your argument is a little less powerful than you articulated.
Let me begin with the last things first. Budget support. Uganda right now receives 60% of its total aid in the form of budget support. 40% comes in the form of project support. Now, budget support is a system where money is directly put into the government budget and the government decides how to spend it. Project support, the donors decide which project they're going to finance. But I don't think there is a fundamental difference. Even if donors spend money through projects, these projects are located inside the government ministries. So still, the resources of aid, largely, about 80% of total project support actually spent through projects located inside the government departments. Then a little bit of it is financed through NGOs and other small organizations or donor organizations directly. About the International Criminal Court indicting Kony, I think that after some time, Museveni recognized that he made a mistake to invite the ICC to the problem in northern Uganda. Because one time, President Museveni called me and Pike on a weekend and said, look, under the ICC law, if a government can find an internal judicial process to resolve or to prosecute offenders of international humanitarian law, then the ICC would become silent on its arrest warrants. In fact, the ICC is always called upon when the domestic process cannot prosecute the offender. And I have never read the ICC law, and I have never taken it seriously. So what I can remember is that Museveni quoted a section of the law which allows Uganda to carry out an internal process. When I had the discussion with Ocampo last year, the ICC prosecutor, he told me that he cannot withdraw the international arrest warrants because whatever Uganda government decides to do in the peace process has nothing to do with the international arrest warrants. So, to be honest, I do not know. Ocampo and Museveni seem to be speaking at a different wavelength.
In the back, would you please identify yourself and make it concise?
Okay, will do. My name is Melvin Coates. I just had a couple questions. You said your paper is independent. How long have y'all been independent?
1 year now.
Okay, 1 year. Are you connected to a tribe in Uganda?
I don't know what that means.
A tribe? I mean, do you have a tribe?
Yes, of course I come from some ethnic group,
okay,
yes.
Okay, so, I mean, what's your tribe and what's the tribe of the ruling party?
The ruling party doesn't have a tribe.
Okay, I'm just concerned because the problem is that you say that you're, the people that you, or, you know, you are enemy against the state or whatever. You said that you're enemy against the state, but then you get commentary from the president. So it just doesn't make sense because independent press here in the U.S. is something totally different because we have rules and...
Okay, but what is the question that you want to...
I'm just trying to say that it's hard to believe your credibility or to believe you. And that's all I'm saying. Your credibility is kind of shot because independent press here is different from independent press in Uganda. And sir, if I may ask, have you been to Africa? Have you been?
I have been. My first visit to Uganda, to answer your question, was in 1962, and I made about 15 trips first. Thank you very much, Mr. Coates. In the next year.
If you wouldn't mind, can you talk about your views on the the PRDP plan in northern Uganda? Your views on that?
I don't know why they have very strong opinions on the PRDP. First of all, let me first answer my friend. Me and President Yoweri Museveni come from literally the same ethnic group. So we almost speak a common language. Although our ethnic groups may be given a different name, he's called Munyankore, I'm called Mutoro, but we come from next to each other and we speak a common language. So if you thought I could sense him because we come from different ethnic groups, please be informed. And my brother works as a director of counterintelligence in military intelligence in Uganda. Another one works in Museveni's arm. And my sister is a member of parliament representing Museveni's party. So I don't criticize him because we have some ethnic differences. I criticize him because I politically disagree with him. Now, the second thing, to come to you about PRDPs, I do not think that the people who control power in Uganda have a vested interest in a rapid decongestion of the camps. I have a suspicion that, you see, Uganda is getting overpopulated. The speed of population growth is 3.5% per year, and there is a lot of pressure on land. And the Uganda government has been signing deals with international organizations and international and other governments giving them land. And I wonder, where are they going to get this land? So there is a suspicion among very many people in northern Uganda that the money barons in Uganda want to actually buy land in Acholi. So if they buy that land, if they are interested in that land, how therefore can they allow people to leave the camps and settle back in their homes? You may have heard that the government of Uganda gave a number of square miles of land to the government of Egypt. President Yoweri Museveni has granted sugar producers Madivani and Meta huge chunks of land in northern Uganda. So, if the government of Uganda is interested in land in northern Uganda, then it is unlikely to support a program of decongesting the camps and resettling people in their homes. I don't think so.
I had one about the military budget and the oversight. You know, you said there was an audit some time ago. I mean, what is the mechanism of oversight over the military budget, or is this kind of extra budgetary spending and so forth? So what would be the process to get a handle on that, A?
Could I just extend your question? Does the Auditor General have the ability to audit the Ministry of Defense, which it did not have 2 or 3 years ago? Has that changed?
Yeah, I think it has changed. They have allowed the Auditor General now to audit the Ministry of Defense, but not to audit classified expenditure. And if you look at the Ministry of Defense budget, first of all, the government of Uganda, the international donors of whom I'm extremely critical, I think have made a lot of, have brought about a lot of changes in the way the government of Uganda budget is done that is really commendable, in the sense that the budget of the government of Uganda is published in books called Estimates of Approved, or it is either draft or approved estimates of public, of government revenue and expenditure. Every year, it's a thick book like this. So you can go item by item and you'll see every single amount of money that is spent on government of Uganda. That's how you would know that recently the president of Uganda just finished renovating his residence at $93 million. You will see it there. Now he's buying a new jet at $60 million. You will find it there in the budget. They can't hide these things. But specifically with the Minister of Defense, you know how much money goes into salaries, how much money goes into so many things. Then you will arrive at more than close to 2/3 of the budget, which is called classified expenditure, where I think they're buying weapons or things like that. You would not know what is constituted in there. And the Auditor General's report, the Auditor General does not audit military arms procurement, no.
Just following up on that, and then another question. Wait, what is the status of the kinds of troops that are deployed in northern Uganda? I mean, you say they have tanks and MiGs and so forth. Are they deployed in Uganda? That's the one question. Well, maybe answer that, and then I'll move. I wanted to ask, too, about kind of what's the status of an opposition movement and the opposition movement.
Okay. The status of the military. You see, I'll give you, there is a report that was, President Yoweri Museveni in 2003 appointed a commission of inquiry to investigate the presence of ghost soldiers on the army register. And the chief of military intelligence appears, at that time Brigadier Nobo Mayombo appears before the commission. So I'm going to quote verbatim what he says in the commission when he's being asked. He said, before Uganda launched Operation Iron Fist in southern Sudan to rout out Konyi, the president sent him and the current army commander, at that time he was the chief of the armored brigade, to go to a place called Aswa Ranch and count soldiers. Before we deploy into southern Sudan, we need to know what is the actual strength of the 4th Division deployed to fight the rebels in northern Uganda. Now, the 4th Division, under Ugandan military establishment, a division is supposed to be 8,200 troops. So Mayombo says, we took all the troops to northern, to Aswa Ranch, put them on a parade, and started counting them head to head. Out of 8,200, how many do you think they found? 2,400. Of those 2,400, the chief of military intelligence said that if you subtracted the administrative corps, the sick and injured, in other words, those who are not combat ready, the effective combat force of 4th Division was 1,200. 1,200. So that should tell you the position of the... Let the chief of military intelligence of Uganda speak rather than me speak. In fact, in that same report, there is a conversation with the former army commander. And he says, one time, they took 400 million shillings to pay soldiers' salaries to the 405 Brigade. When they arrived, the president had sent a woman to go and... They wanted to understand, how do we eliminate those soldiers? They said, okay, take cash directly, line up soldiers, and say, Joe Bakan, Kano, please come get your salary. They pay them face to face so that they avoid this problem of ghost soldiers. And they appointed civilian paymasters. So a lady called Kano Nakayenga, a civilian called Nakayenga, arrives in a helicopter with 400 million. And they call a man called Kano Dradiga, line up your troops to pay. And a battalion, a brigade under Uganda's military establishment is 2,300. So they said, where is your brigade? Let us pay their salaries. There are no soldiers. So the commission is so shocked because they changed and even asked the question in English. He said, when we asked for the parade, there were no soldiers, and we had notified him 2 weeks earlier. Then they asked in Swahili, onasema talukua askari ata moja. Are you saying that there isn't even a single soldier? He answered, ata moja, meaning not a single one. So that is the army that has been fighting Chikonyi. Ladies and gentlemen, ghosts don't fight wars. Real soldiers do. Then you asked about the opposition. Yes, the opposition in Uganda is very weak for the following reasons. One, I think it is very weak on message. They oppose Museveni for the sake, I think, of opposing him, but they do not have a strong alternative message of what it is that they want to do. So their strength is negative legitimacy. They ride on the failures of Museveni without offering an alternative of what it is that they want to do. And I think that has diminished their credibility in the eyes of Ugandans. Two, the opposition in Uganda has failed to mobilize Ugandans who are tired of the government to raise money. Without money, the opposition is unable to build an effective organizational infrastructure across the country to spread their message, even if they have a very weak message. So the lack of money has meant that they have weak organization, and the lack of message has also meant that they have limited appeal beyond the fact of negative legitimacy, i.e. highlighting Museveni's failures. However, because of 22 years of Museveni's rule, people are tired of him. There's a lot of corruption in Uganda, although the economy is growing at a very good pace. Just the sheer fact that the guy has been there for a very long time and his people are so corrupt is enough to mobilize sufficient numbers, even to defeat Museveni in an election, even though the opposition is poorly organized.
Could you elaborate a little bit more then on who might be a viable candidate against Museveni in the next election? You seem to be implying that Beseje and is really not able to cut it.
I think that Besigye has been very effective in rallying and mobilizing those who disagree with Museveni without building... In other words, he's able to rally the base, Sarah Palin style, without... He's able to rally the base without broadening it. And that is his great limitation. I do not think that if a person was sitting on the fence or is agnostic about Museveni, Besigye is the kind of guy who can win their following. He has been very weak on that. Well, at least they always vote against Museveni 90%.
I have two quick questions.
Okay, you and then you. Please identify yourself.
I have two quick questions, essentially. First, does other parliamentary committees that have access, at least to some of the defense budget, or can look oversee that? The second question is, the sentiment, at least from a lot of Ugandans in Kenya, is that Museveni is a stable person. Uganda is a very factitious nation, and the fact that he's there and creates some form of environment is much better than opening it up for a democratic opposition, which would probably lean towards ethnic violence.
To answer your last question, I'm not very sure that Museveni himself is not. In fact, I think that Museveni has led to greater polarization in Uganda. Without him, I believe, whatever opposition that comes, there will be greater national consensus than under him. Remember that he's a very belligerent politician. And two, you see, if Museveni were defeated today, the era of one-man rule would end in Uganda. Whichever person replaces him will not have the charisma, the historical contribution he has made. In other words, more collective leadership would emerge. Right now, you have one-man rule. After 70, you can only have collective leadership. No one single individual will be able on their own to run roughshod over the rest of Uganda. Nobody. In which case, really, there would be a proper balance and negotiation of power between regions and political interests. Remember that the major fault line of Uganda's politics has never been tribes, except for Buganda. It has always been religion, divided between Catholics and Protestants, and religion cuts across all ethnic groups. There are Catholics and Protestants from north southern Uganda. And so Uganda's problem has never been like that of Kenya. Joel possibly would know that better than me, except for the Kingdom of Buganda, which has sometimes voted as one block. The political fault line of Uganda's politics has always been Catholics versus Protestants.
Maya Sobel, Exclusive Analysis Limited. I have a couple questions, one hearkening back to the Gulf soldiers question. Earlier you had quoted that the troop strength is 50,000 strong for the Ugandan army. Is that the ghost strength or is that the real strength? And if it's including ghost soldiers, what is the actual then troop strength of the army? And the second question is sort of jumping off some of the other questions about opposition. And if there is all, you know, the corruption as it is, and there is building opposition, sort of what percentage of the population is part of the patronage network and therefore isn't inclined to change? And what does the rest of the population, not necessarily those active in the opposition, kind of feel, sort of hearkening back to the people sitting on the fence? What are they looking for?
Yeah, those are two excellent questions, and if I could just add an addendum to your first one, could you give us a bit more detail of not only the strength of the army today, not in 2003, I think that was really the thrust of your question, but also say something about the Presidential Guard Brigade and the troops that are in Somalia, which I believe are still 1,500, or is it more?
Let me begin with the troop strength. You see, it's very difficult to establish the actual troop strength of Uganda. I know the troop strength of the Presidential Guard Brigade. It's 10,000 troops strong. So you have 10,000 troops in the Presidential Guard Brigade guarding one man. Remember we had said you had 1,200 guarding 1.8 million people living in internally displaced camps, being attacked daily by Konya and being killed. When President Yoweri Museveni goes to northern Uganda, now you have it from me, from authority, and I'm a big authority on these issues, at the risk of sounding extremely modest. He goes with the Presidential Guard Brigade. Museveni has limited interest in the mainstream army. So right now we cannot tell. They could, out of that 56, there are supposed to be 56,000 troops. I am sure there are about 29,000. That is the actual strength of the army. And of course, then there is his special Presidential Guard Brigade. So how does he sometimes fill the gaps? You see, they have the auxiliary forces. Remember that for every rebellion Museveni has confronted, he has formed an ethnic militia. When it was in Teso, they formed the Arrow Boys. When it was in Lango, they formed Amuka. And when they were in Acholi, they formed the Vigilantes. Then they have the Vigilantes. Then they have the Kalodushka Action Plan. They have so many ethnic militias they have trained to confront the rebellion. Now, in Acholi land alone, what they call vigilantes or home guards constituted about 70,000. So when you hear that the actual army was 2,400, the entire division, those were not the only guys who were fighting. There was the militia. The militia was about 7. In that report, you see that it is about 70,000 strong. But even that more than a third of that itself were ghosts. So, yes, the militias also constituted a huge component that were ghosts. That is why it's so important to read that report. I have it on, I don't know whether I have it on my laptop here, but I know that I have it on my desktop in office, the soft copy of the report, and it states the perversity of ghosts, even in the militias. So that is one. The second is on patronage. You see, to understand Africa's politics is to understand how different they may be from here. You see, and this explains actually why you have very weak delivery of public services. Because for Museveni to retain his position, his strategy has been that if you go to the market for elites with experience, with a national stature, and with skills to provide organization and leadership to the infrastructure of opposition politics, he has crowded the opposition out of it. How? He has 71 ministers, 114 presidential advisors who never see him except on television. And when they see him, it's at public functions like this one, and if there, it is him who advises them. Then he has about 66 ambassadors, yet Uganda has about 15 missions abroad. He has been creating a district out of every village. Now we have 81 districts and counting. He found them at 33. A district in Uganda will have a cabinet, a parliament, and a bureaucracy, just replicating the central government. So he has created, subtract 33 from 81. What do you get? He has created about 48 districts. He has created 48 new districts. No, 58 new districts. 58. So not only that, he's now creating 16 new districts, so they're going to be 97 by end of this year, by end of next year, by the time he runs again. Then he has 135 commissions and semi-autonomous government bodies. So although he privatized state enterprises, he has been creating so many regulatory agencies on every arm and leg of our existence. But all those are areas of patronage. So if you go to the Ugandan profile book, who are the people of great profile? Politicians everyone respects, they have experience, they have skills, and they have stature to offer leadership and organization to the opposition. They are all in government. So the opposition is emasculated through one of the most perverse neo-patrimonial systems you can find on that continent. And I think Moi was stupid because Moi left so many people out in the cold, and then they organized and united to fight him. It is so difficult to mobilize a critical mass of elites to oppose Museveni.
But you just gave the bottom line to your argument in your formal talk. The donors cut the funds to Moi, and he had print money or loot. In this case, the donors financed the neo-patrimonial regime.
Oh, yeah, Museveni has been very smart. He has outfoxed donors. Because, you see, the donors actually had a very good agenda. One, they pushed liberalization, which would take resources into the private sector and allow competition. Privatization, it would take state patronage. Government was appointing its friends and relatives, its friends and allies into positions in parastatals. All these parastatals were sold. But you see, as they liberalized the economy, a new thing emerged. If they were dismantling the coffee marketing board, they had to create the Coffee Development Authority, Uganda Coffee Development Authority. If they removed the Lindt Marketing Board, they created the Lindt, the Cotton Development Authority. When they privatized Uganda Electricity Board, they created three institutions, the Uganda Electricity Regulatory Authority, which is the regulator, and some other institution. They have been creating the Uganda Road Authority. We have the Uganda Broadcasting Corporation, the Uganda Broadcasting Council, which monitors those of us who broadcast. We have the Uganda Communications Commission, which regulates the telecommunications. So they have created so many institutions everywhere that today the size of the state is larger than under the parastatal sector. The difference, of course, is that by putting the economy in private hands, you do not have public servants, civil servants running businesses of government. So the economy can retain dynamism, although this huge public sector is a big parasite or predator on private sector initiatives. So Museveni was able to use donors' own language. The donors were talking of decentralization and taking services closer to the people democratic participation. And what did he do? He created a district out of every village. Even me at my home, I may ask for a district so that me, my wife, and our children constitute a district authority, and then we get foreign aid. finance our domestic, our home health and the education.
I just have a follow-up on that. If he's been smart enough then to actually expand that patronage network to such a critical mass that anyone who sort of cares, I guess, or has any sort of stake actually themselves are also benefiting from this influx of aid, your recommendation then to sort of stop giving aid or to lower aid, I mean, it just seems completely impractical. This is not a matter of just upsetting Museveni. You're going to upset, you would upset the whole country. So what's, I mean, where does then your argument as perhaps a very principled one in terms of getting rid of corruption and getting rid of patrimonio and getting rid of these principled bad things, but how does that fit in with then what...
Well, without the aid to pay for all these agencies, let me answer your question. Without aid to pay for all these agencies, I can assure you, if you can't pay those guys, they will run and join the ranks of the opposition. In fact, if you want to regime change in Uganda, you have to limit the capacity of the state to bribe elites with jobs. So the result would be that he would have to shut down many of these organizations and institutions he has set, put in place. In shutting them down, he would directly be sending them to join the opposition.
So you would say that the people who are currently benefiting from patronage through the ranks of foreign aid, receiving that patronage or being part of that network, however directly or indirectly, isn't akin, however, to loyalty, and therefore if the aid dropped out, their loyalty's gone and they just...
Yeah, yeah. That's what I'm saying.
Okay.
Anyone else? In the back?
So, are you saying...
Could you please identify yourself?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Barbara Paulson, National Geographic. Earlier you were saying that there's very little incentive to dismantle the IDP camps in the north. Are you saying if one were to go to northern Uganda right now, you would not see any people leaving the camps and resettling in their homes and villages?
Well, there are people are resettling in northern Uganda, but the incentive on the part of government to accelerate that process has been very slow. Remember that there has been peace in northern Uganda for 2 years, and they have only resettled about 200,000 out of about 1.8 million people. So you should ask yourself, why? Why don't we see a mass exodus of people from camps back to their homes? Because the government has been reluctant to facilitate that process. These are my suspicions. I could be wrong, you know, and I hope I'm wrong. But I think that the government is interested in land in northern Uganda.
And because you said that they're selling off that land?
Yeah, the government has been granting concession, land concessions. But we don't know, we don't have the maps of which. They signed an agreement with the government of Egypt. They give them about 20,000 square miles of land or something like that. It's such a huge chunk of land, I don't know where they will manufacture it from. Remember that land is a fixed asset. So whichever the land Museveni has been offering, then he has given the sugar corporations, Madivani and Meta, huge 6,000 square acres of land, each one of them. Where is he getting it? So my suspicion is that he's looking at the large tracts of land in northern Uganda that are unoccupied for him to distribute patronage, first of all, to those who finance his campaigns, the private sector, and that gets into the way of resettling people from in the camps. And that is why there's a slow process of resettlement.
Didn't USAID have a program there to facilitate the resettlements? And unfortunately, the two people who were here from aid had to leave early.
I don't know.
David Sullivan, Enough Project. Thank you, Andrew. Looking elsewhere in the world, I think you see, and I'm thinking of Pakistan right now, a slow realization on the part of U.S. policymakers that it may be wiser to have policies that, instead of dealing solely with personalities, or start to kind of address the populations. Now, looking at a place like Uganda, if foreign aid is part of the problem, is there anything that the U.S. can do to try to engage with the Ugandan population rather than leadership personalities in order to improve the situation?
If you ask me about the U.S. government, I am not a fan of the U.S. government. First of all, when the United States government gives you aid, if the president says we are going to give money to anybody, that money has to be appropriated by Congress. When the Senate and the House sit to appropriate that money, lobbyists arrive. The senator from Delaware will receive a delegation of some computer company there that would want to have a cut, a piece of the pie. Then the congressman from, let's say, which county in Florida there that he had controversy in 2000. Let's call it Santa Clara County.
Wrong state.
Yes. He will also arrive and say, we have a company here, we need this. By the time the money is finally parceled out, for every $5 the American government is giving you, four will be taken by American companies. Hardly does that money ever arrive. So although the United States politicians are the most prominent in saying we are the kindest society, first of all, in my culture, if you give somebody something, you must keep quiet about it. But I hear Bush saying, oh, we are the most generous people in the world. Actually, the United States government is not generous. They give you with one hand and they take away with another. So basically, money does not arrive. So I will not discuss the United States. Possibly, I should discuss other donors. What should they do? The Americans are smart enough to ensure that the money given to you is always taken back by them. Rather, not the Americans, the American government. That is an important distinction. Because I know if Joe gave you money here, he would not go announcing it and he would not take it away again. But then we come to the other donors. What we need to do with aid. First of all, I think that aid is attracted to Africa's failures rather than its accomplishments. That is a fundamental problem. It looks at failures rather than accomplishments. And therefore, when it arrives, it comes subsidized incompetence and dysfunction rather than to finance innovation and creativity. I'll give you an example. If you come to my village, I was doing a documentary for BBC, so it will be on BBC World on Sunday. You see, if you go to my village, you will find two types of farmers. There is a farmer who is an innovator, who has bought an exotic cow and is crossbreeding it with an African cow. The African cow has high levels of disease resistance but has low milk yield. The European cow has very high, low resistance but has high milk yield. So if you crossbreed them, you get high milk yield and high resistance. So you have that farmer. He's employing fertilizer in order to increase output per acreage of land that he's cultivating. That is one farmer. There's a second farmer. So this farmer is increasingly becoming prosperous because he's innovative. But then there is a neighboring farmer. The last time he collected money from microcredit, he married a second and third wife or added a concubine. Increased how much he spends in the nearby bar. And even his children have fallen out of school. So clearly for me, this farmer, right now he cannot afford to pay fees for his kids. He can't even send them, he cannot give them proper health care. When the international aid community arrives, it comes to support the farmer who is failing, not the farmer who is succeeding. But when you put money into a dysfunctional system, you accentuate the dysfunction. See, donors think they can fix Africa's weaknesses. I think they cannot. Because often our dysfunctions are beneficial to those who are in control of the dysfunction. You go to a healthcare system that is broken, it's because people are benefiting from it. Donors think they can fix it. My own view is this. If you go to a country like Rwanda, they have innovated the best healthcare system I have visited anywhere in the world for a poor country. National health insurance, and it's working so well. If you are donors, they have done a good innovation, they have been creative, they are succeeding, finance them. Give them money because the government has proved it can perform very well. I should add that there are certain pockets of the government of Uganda that are competent and succeeding. Support those. If you come to a healthcare system like that of Uganda, which is collapsing, hospitals are death traps rather than places for healthcare. Do not put in money because now you have the private sector in Uganda that is providing better quality health services. So what do you do? Give the private sector this money so that they can get poor people to come there and receive healthcare at a cheaper price. Do not try to fix weaknesses. Try to leverage these people's strength, the nation's strength. That's always my advice.
Okay, David, and then next to you.
David Hynek with the Africa program here. So what do you think about the Millennium Challenge Corporation and the way that new structure of foreign assistance Is that beneficial? And I'm sorry, I don't know if Uganda is a threshold program or not. I don't.
It was kicked out. No, we were kicked out, yes.
So what do you think about that line of foreign assistance?
Possibly it works. Possibly it works. I have not done any research on it. But what I would say is I do not think that the good behavior on the part of governments in Africa should be instigated by the international community. I personally think that we should create incentives whereby governments in Africa can find it in their own self-interest to improve the quality of governance. African leaders do not need to be told by Western politicians how they should run their own affairs. I personally think that's a very weak strategy. The best strategy is an incentive structure where the government finds it in its own self-interest, or the survival of a regime depends on it being able to be responsive to the needs of its own citizens. And one of the ways of actually doing it is to increase the threat that the governments face. I'll give you an example of Rwanda. After the genocide, Rwanda emerged out of that genocide with a different mentality. The Tutsi, who control power and are a minority and almost faced extermination yesterday, understand that the price of failure is so high, they cannot afford the luxury of incompetence. And that, for me, is a very important lesson. The idea that some African government can go around with its incompetence, enjoy itself in its incompetence, and then the international world comes to subsidize that incompetence and corruption, that's a danger. So the states need to face existential threats. You see, when these African governments face threats of a strategic or tactical nature, but they have never faced existential threats, except Rwanda. That's why it has a different mentality. So the existence of these regimes must be under threat for them to think of how they can do things differently.
Paul Ronan with Resolve Uganda. Just two questions. One, could you talk a bit about Karamoja and the prospects for resolving the conflict there? And then two, talking about the challenges that Museveni will face in 2011 if he does run again. Could you talk about the past few months? There's been many reports of a split between the Baganda and Museveni, primarily over land, and then also there's been many reports about kind of high-level discontent within the NRM with Museveni, people that want to advance and kind of see themselves blocked by his
state. Karamoja, I hardly know anything about Karamoja, so I will not answer your question on Karamoja because I'm not an expert on it. Where my views are weak, I don't comment. But will Museveni win an election? I think Museveni faces a number of threats. One, if he's not careful, we may see a mind split inside the NRM. Whether it will materialize remains open to question. I'm not so sure. In fact, I believe most likely that it will not happen. But there's a lot of internal infighting in the NRM. So that is the problem he faces, that you could have many senior leaders breaking away. But they won't. Because Museveni has demonstrated that the costs of opposition to him are so high. He will arrest you, charge you with rape, add their treason, and when the courts try to release you, he will put their terrorism and take you to a military court martial. So he can do anything, Date. And two, if you acquiesce to his machinations, he will give you a job in the government, an official car, a salary, and unofficial opportunities to profit from corruption. So for most people, therefore, it is better to deal with him than to oppose him. The cost of opposition are so high, and the returns from collaboration are also high, so it is better to collaborate than to oppose. The second is what may hit him is what he does not expect, that his system is moribund. You know, I think there has been a loss of an overriding incentive. You see, material incentives are very important, but they're not sufficient, by the way, to drive a powerful movement. I do not think that most of the young people who turned up to vote for Barack Obama were expecting a return in form of a check in their pocket. So ideals are very, very important. And Museveni lost the moral purpose to power. His only survival depends on him providing material incentives. And I find material incentives insufficient to mobilize people in a passionate way to go out and work for him. So come 2011, the infrastructure that's always organized and mobilized for him and rigged for him is right now discontented. the material incentives are no longer sufficient because the new patrimonial system has grown too large for there to be too much money for every one of them. Two, the lack of moral purpose. So I fear that many people may not turn up to vote for Museveni, to rig for him, to intimidate for him, and in the process he may lose by default, just like Mugabe in the last election. He may wake up one morning and find that actually the opposition have defeated him and he cannot turn the hands of the clock. So that's the risk he runs.
Actually, that's a very interesting final point, because what you're really saying there is that there's a pattern that we first saw with Moy of inflationary patronage that you can't keep up with it if you keep ratcheting it up. And yet it also underscores the basic point that you made at the end of your formal presentation, that the international donors community really bears much of this. And I might add, since I noticed you're wearing a badge from the bank, the bank is the big dispenser of budget support and has just refused to wrap its head around the link between budget support and the supply of patronage. And if you want to talk on the side more about that, I can. Andrew can tell you my own experience. Jennifer, I think it's pretty much time to wrap up, but Jennifer, you had one more question?
It was asked.
Andrew, thank you again for coming by on a busy trip. We hope to see you again, and keep us posted on how it turns out after your return home.
And congratulations on the award.
Yes. Thank you also. Congratulations on the award. Well deserved.